These familiar three notes begin one of the most famous piano pieces ever written, Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor. Written when Rachmaninoff was still a teenager, its fame quickly spread throughout the world. For the next 51 years, until he died, his audiences would sit enthralled through his piano concerts. At the end of the concerts, they would keep applauding, cheering, clapping, and asking for more encores until he would finally play the Prelude in C-sharp minor. It is a very dramatic work. Written in ABA form, this prelude starts out very slowly. The A section that you hear in the background now gets slower and softer, almost lulling the audience to sleep, until it suddenly bursts into a very energetic and exciting B section. When we finally get back to section A, it is not played super soft, but super loud. How loud? Not forte, not even fortissimo, but fortissa issa issimo. Four fortes in a row, preceded by an S, which means to strike with force. Listen carefully now and see if you can hear when section B, the fast section, begins. Raise your hand when you hear section A return fortissa issa issimo. That is an exciting piece. You can understand why people would stand up and scream and cheer and yell until he would finally play it in his concerts. They probably stood up and screamed and cheered and yelled after he played it in his concert, too. Rachmaninoff had his share of success in life. He also had his share of failure. No one leaves this life without his share of problems. No one is exempt. That's what life is all about. And life is never fair. And the sooner we accept that, the sooner we can begin a full, rich life. Born in Russia to a wealthy family in 1873, Rachmaninoff's father was better at spending money than making it. Gradually, nearly all the family possessions were sold off to pay the father's debts. Finally, his mother and father fought and finally divorced. With all of the strain of family life, Rachmaninoff began failing in school. His mother grew very concerned and asked a cousin what she should do. Now, Rachmaninoff had been studying piano with his mother and at the conservatory at St. Petersburg. When his cousin, who was a famous musician of his time, heard the little boy play, he told the mother that the boy had no discipline. He further recommended that the boy leave home and go to Moscow to study with a strict disciplinarian named Zverev. Zverev was a piano teacher in Moscow with a very interesting approach. See if you would like to do it this way. First of all, he was very wealthy and gave his piano lessons free. So far, so good. Secondly, when you studied piano with Zverev, he required that you lived with him. Can you imagine living with your piano teacher so he could make sure you practiced every day? And boy, did they practice. The few boys that were accepted to live and study with Zverev were to be up and practicing by 6 a.m. every morning. They studied harmony and theory and repertoire. In the days before stereos and recordings, if you wanted to study a symphony or other orchestral work, you could buy them in arrangements for the piano. These arrangements were most often written as piano duets. Many people would study the piano transcriptions of the orchestral work before they would go to the concert. Many people knew the work quite well before it was even first performed. On Sunday afternoons, Zverev would invite many of the most famous musicians of the day to his home for his students to meet. He felt if they were to be great, they needed to associate with the great. Rachmaninoff was so proud when he was asked on one occasion to lead Anton Rubinstein, the famous pianist, to dinner by holding on to Rubinstein's long coattails. One evening, while the students were sitting around the table, they decided that they should each compose something. The idea had never occurred to them before. Quickly, they all began writing their own compositions. After Zverev had studied Rachmaninoff's 2 pages of scribbles, he realized the boy had talent as a composer. But Zverev was not interested in training composers, only pianists. Rachmaninoff, however, was known to be stubborn and very strong-willed at times. He continued to compose. Finally, he went to Zverev to complain. "How can you expect me to compose when all of the other boys are practicing all around me?" Rachmaninoff asked for his own room and a place where he could compose in quiet. An argument broke out between the two. The teacher told his student that if he wanted a private place, he could find it outside of his home. Rachmaninoff left the house and went to live with a relative while attending the Moscow Conservatory. His former teacher would not speak to him for the next 3 years. At the Moscow Conservatory, Rachmaninoff worked hard and was ready to graduate a year early. Part of the graduation examination was to play their own piano composition for a panel of judges. The highest score a student could receive was a 5. The great composer Peter Tchaikovsky was asked to be one of the judges. When he heard Rachmaninoff's composition, he rated Rachmaninoff a 5+. Seeing Tchaikovsky's pleasure with the composition, Rachmaninoff's proud teacher asked him to play another one. As Tchaikovsky listened, he scribbled on Rachmaninoff's examination paper. Later, Rachmaninoff found that he had added 3 more pluses to the 5. This had never happened before. News traveled quickly throughout Moscow of Rachmaninoff's 4 pluses and a 5. After graduation from high school or the conservatory, Rachmaninoff signed a contract to sell his compositions to a publisher. One of these was the prelude in C-sharp minor that we discussed at the beginning of this tape. Another was the famous Polichinelle. Let's listen to a portion of the Polichinelle now. Rachmaninoff's career seemed to take off slowly. At first, he began teaching piano, performing concerts, and composing. But it takes time for an international reputation to develop as he wanted. He was very excited when he was asked for permission to perform his first symphony in St. Petersburg. He was now 23 years old. I can just imagine the excitement he must have felt at hearing his symphony for the first time by an orchestra. He had composed it at the piano and had never heard it performed before. He had only heard it in his head and at the piano. He made a trip down to St. Petersburg to watch the orchestra rehearse. Ah, his first time to hear his composition. The orchestra was scheduled to rehearse the symphony for the first time only a few hours before the audience would be invited in. Rachmaninoff found a seat in the back of the auditorium as the orchestra began his piece. He was struck with horror. Could that be music that he had written? It sounded awful. Could these be notes he had composed? No, the orchestra was not playing it right. It couldn't be. The conductor was drunk. He really was. He wanted to cancel the whole thing, but the audience would be coming in just a few short hours. When the audience finally did arrive, Rachmaninoff could not stay in the concert hall. He sat outside the stage door where he could barely hear. After a time, even that was more than he could bear. He finally slipped off into the night, not wanting to be seen by anyone he knew. The next morning, the critics were proclaiming Rachmaninoff's failure. As Harold Schoenberg said, it wasn't that hardly anybody liked it, it was that nobody liked it. Whatever the reasons for its early failure, some critics place it at the forefront of Rachmaninoff's early creations. He was so disheartened after the premiere that although he retained the piano version of the work, he hid the full score so no one could find it, and it has remained unlocated to this day. The orchestral parts used for the first performance in St. Petersburg were the basis for a reconstruction carried out not long after the composer died. But even though people like it now, no one in St. Petersburg liked it then. Depressed, Rachmaninoff wrote nearly nothing for 3 years. He did continue to give concerts, however. On a tour to England, he found that he was famous outside of Russia. This was a surprise to him. His prelude in C-sharp minor had preceded him. People were anxious to hear him play. But Rachmaninoff wanted to continue to compose. He sought out the help of a hypnotist. Lying on a couch, the hypnotist, who was also an amateur musician, would say over and over to Rachmaninoff, "You will write a concerto. You will write a concerto. You will write a concerto. It will come to you easily. It will be excellent." Rachmaninoff did begin writing again. He dedicated it to the hypnotist that had helped him. The concerto he wrote turned out to be one of his best known and well-loved pieces. Rachmaninoff eventually got married and had two little girls whom he adored. He loved to spend his summers out in the country, working alongside the farmers in hard physical labor. In 1917, Rachmaninoff and his family were living in Moscow. He could see that things would soon come to a head and the Bolshevik Revolution would break out. He wanted to get his family out of Russia to safety. He tried to get permission to leave the country, but was unable to. When the revolution started, he and his family could hear machine guns and fighting from their home. One day, a letter came inviting him to give a series of recitals in Scandinavia. Here was his chance. He went to the government and asked if he would be allowed to leave on a concert tour. The new government was happy to have him represent their country. They wanted to show the world how normal and successful the new government was. He also asked if he could take his family. To this request, the Russians were a little more hesitant. They didn't want someone like Rachmaninoff immigrating away from Russia. The Russians eventually said yes, but to ensure that he would return, they required that he would only take a very small sum of money and a small amount of clothes. No other possessions were to be taken. Rachmaninoff went home to tell the news to his family. They had to be very careful so that the neighbors would not suspect that they were leaving for good and tell the authorities. Rachmaninoff left first by himself. A few days later, his wife and children followed. It was Christmas time. They boarded a train that took them toward the border. No train went clear across the border, so when the train came to the end of the line, they had to rent a horse-drawn sleigh. A farmer drove the sleigh while the Rachmaninoffs buried themselves under blankets for a long trip. When they finally arrived, they could hardly believe the difference between Scandinavia and Russia. Christmas cheer was everywhere to welcome a war-weary, exhausted family. They had made it to freedom. Rachmaninoff's flight from Russia came just in time, for after he left, the government decided that too many of its best people were leaving the country. To make sure they returned, the communists would keep a family member hostage until the rest of the family returned. Although the Rachmaninoffs arrived to freedom with very little money, work was not hard to find for the famous pianist. He remembered that he had been well received in the United States of America, and so decided to take his family there. When he arrived, he was amazed. Just as in England, his compositions had preceded him. He found himself already established and famous. The years passed. Rachmaninoff continued to compose, conduct, and perform. When Rachmaninoff turned 70, he decided it was time to make his last concert tour. Unfortunately, it was never finished. After his last concert in Knoxville, he became so ill they took him back to his home in Beverly Hills. There it was discovered that he had cancer. On March 28, 1943, he died. As a pianist, Rachmaninoff was considered to be one of the greatest who ever lived. He had huge hands and a breathtaking technique that he seemed born with. As a boy, he would go to church with his grandmother, listen to the choir, and then come home and play the music that he had heard in the service on the piano. He could do the same thing with orchestral music at a concert. He could hear the orchestra play a symphony, and then go home and play it on the piano. His memory was equally astonishing. If he had played or heard a piece of music once, years later he could pull it back out of his memory as if it had been yesterday. With this as an introduction to Rachmaninoff as a pianist, we are going to focus on the meaning of four words. Words that will describe Rachmaninoff's style of piano playing and help you understand the choices that are available to you as a performer. The four words are, and you may want to write these down, literalist, romantic, groover, mover. We could very appropriately organize the four words as opposites. Just as day is the opposite of night, a literalist is the opposite of a romantic. A groover is the opposite of a mover. Now that they are organized into opposites, let's explore what each word means. Let's start with the words literal versus romantic. To be literal means to be exact. Literate literally means lettered, or someone who can read and write with letters. Later, it became associated with the scripture and famous phrase, following the letter of the law, or to follow the law exactly as it was written. Now, the opposite of literal is romantic. One of the definitions of romantic in the dictionary is having no basis in fact, or not exact. When we are in love, humans have a tendency to exaggerate. The sky is bluer, the flowers are more beautiful than ever, she is the most beautiful girl or the handsomest boy that we have ever seen. A romantic is not exact due to his own personal feelings. Now, let me give you an example of how this relates to music. As a young student of the piano, I once had the opportunity to play a Beethoven sonata for three judges. I was very pleased with my performance, but when the results came back, I was marked very low. I was a little angry and went to my teacher and asked why I was marked so low when I played so well. My teacher replied, "They marked you low because you changed some of the phrasing and dynamics that Beethoven had written in the score." "I played it the way I felt it," I protested, "and I liked it that way." My teacher paused for a moment and then said, "But they didn't." I had played the Beethoven as a romantic in front of judges who were literalists. A few months later, I had the opportunity of playing in front of the judges again. I became a convert to literalism, knowing the judges. The purpose of this discussion is not to persuade you to be a literalist or a romantic. It is to make you aware of the choices that are available to you. Now that you know the difference and a little bit about Rachmaninoff, which do you suppose he was? Do you suppose Rachmaninoff was a literalist or a romantic? Rachmaninoff was generally considered to be a romantic. He was not interested in recreating the feelings and ideas of the original composer exactly as they had intended. He was generally more interested in using the pieces he played as vehicles of his own feelings and ideas. In a moment, I'm going to have you stop the tape. Listen carefully as I give you instructions. Write down 5 pianists that you know. Include yourself as one of the pianists or musicians. Also include your teacher or any fellow students or directors that you work with. After you have listed your 5 musicians, write whether they are literalists or romantics in the way they play their pieces. Stop the tape and do it now. The fact is, you do not have to be all one way or all the other. Now, there are those who think you must be all one way or all the other, but you can change from piece to piece. Work carefully with your teacher. Make sure that you do not decide to be a romantic just because you lack the discipline to follow the interpretive markings in the music. The other two words we discussed were groovers versus the movers. On a record player, the needle is placed into a groove. As the record spins around on the turntable, the needle follows the groove very exactly and rigidly toward the center of the record. When Rachmaninoff performed on the piano, he was a groover. He held his body very still while his arms and hands flew over the keys, creating works of great beauty. Horowitz, another great pianist of this century, was also a groover. He held very still as he performed, very little movement. In contrast to groovers, we have movers, those who enjoy moving, almost dancing with their bodies as they play the music. Some teachers even choreograph their students to move certain ways at certain times as they play their pieces for effect. I have even seen professional pianists get so excited that they have stomped their feet, not tapped their feet, but stomped their feet in rhythm to the energetic music they were playing. I have heard Leonard Bernstein sing and grunt as he played the piano. I once had a student who played beautifully in a festival. When the results came back, he was scored low. Why? Just as I had played as a romantic for a group of literalists, my student had been prepared to play as a groover for a mover. Again, the reason for defining the opposites in style is to help you see that there are great artists that play as romantics and great artists who play as literalists. Great artists that are groovers and great artists that are movers. There is no crime in being one or the other. The real crime is intolerance for others' ideas. The real crime is being so stuck in one camp that you cannot see the value and beauty of diversity and contrast. In a moment, I'm going to have you stop the tape. I would like you to take the same five names that you identified as literalists and romantics and decide whether they are groovers or movers when they play and perform. Stop the tape and do it now. With Rachmaninoff playing as a romantic, you would expect him to be a mover. But the exact opposite was true. Although he played with great emotion and intensity, yet his physical demeanor was very cool and reserved on stage. Rachmaninoff and Horowitz knew each other. Horowitz was greatly influenced by Rachmaninoff. If you have access to the popular movie Horowitz in Moscow, you can see a wonderful example of the Rachmaninoff style in Horowitz, a kind of groovy romantic. It is interesting to note, in conclusion, that had Rachmaninoff stayed in St. Petersburg and not followed the advice of his cousin to study with the disciplinarian Zverev in Moscow, he may have turned out to be a completely different composer than we know him today. The conservatory in St. Petersburg was thought to be much more progressive, exploring new ideas, leaning toward the weird, strange, and avant-garde. Prokofiev, composer of the famous Peter and the Wolf, was trained in St. Petersburg and delighted in getting people riled up because of the strange effects in his music. In contrast, the Moscow Conservatory was very conservative, as you would expect it to be in the capital of a country. The music written did not try to turn people off through strange effects. Tchaikovsky was a leader in this school. His music was well known and loved by many of the people of his day and continues to be performed, yet many refused to acknowledge Tchaikovsky as a composer. Why? Because he was liked by so many people. It was a strange phenomenon of the first three quarters of our century that many musicians and composers thought that if people liked you, you could not possibly be a real composer. As a matter of fact, when I was in college studying music history, I remember looking through our text, which was a highly acclaimed and widely used book. It struck me as odd that no mention of Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninoff was even mentioned in the book. I raised my hand and asked the teacher, who was an internationally known and respected musicologist, why the book did not even mention these two great composers. He looked at me and said, "Because they are not composers." I laughed and asked, "Well, what are they then?" I could see by the look in his eye that my laugh did not set well with him. Rachmaninoff was thought of as Tchaikovsky's successor. Consequently, he came under the same criticism as Tchaikovsky. They wrote beautiful melodies in a time that did not like beautiful melodies. They wrote music that appealed to a large number of people in an age of musical elitism. An age where, when any composer that wrote music that was liked by many people was held suspect, thought of as selling out. Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians has long been thought of as the most respected musical dictionary. Its fifth edition reflects the strange attitude many musicians and scholars had toward these two musicians and many others like them. Only two paragraphs were devoted to Rachmaninoff. Here's what they said.
As a pianist, Rachmaninoff was one of the finest artists of his time. As a composer, he can hardly be said to have belonged to his time at all. Technically, he was highly gifted, but also severely limited. His music is well constructed and effective, but monotonous in texture. The enormous popular success some few of Rachmaninoff's works had in his lifetime is not likely to last, and musicians never regarded it with much favor.
This was an amazingly snobbish attitude held by Groves, and as Groves said, an attitude held by other musicians, many others. They predicted that Rachmaninoff's popularity would never last. The truth is, Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky's music continues to be as popular as ever, while the golden boys of the musical establishment, Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, are fading. It is a lesson in integrity and honesty to self that Rachmaninoff, in spite of the mean attitude of other musicians, stayed true to his own ideas of how to write his music the way he felt it.